You are tuned in to Cultivating Indigenous Voices from KXCI Tucson, hosted and produced by Tina Andrew. In this interview, I feature Loris Taylor, President and CEO of Native Public Media.
I'm Loris Taylor, and I'm the President and CEO of Native Public Media. I come from Oroibi Village on the Hopi Reservation. My father came from Acoma Pueblo, so Kowatsi to everyone. And so I'm a homegirl. I grew up in a village where we just didn't have radio or television back in the day, and not even electricity. The fact that I'm working with radio and television and digital platforms is kind of ironic, but I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much. So before we get more about how you got involved in radio, can you tell us about the history of Native Public Media? What is that? How did that come to be and why was that important?
I think that's a really excellent question. And I think in order to give context to this network that we have and which I consider our assets to Indian country, we have to go back in history just a bit. As you know, tribal nations and their citizens have gone through a really tumultuous history on these lands. So I know there was a period of time when extermination was a huge issue. You know, people were dying on the lands and at the hands of others. This was followed by assimilation, where they were trying to turn us into people that we weren't. Followed by acculturation, saying that, well, maybe you can be both. And during this period, I remember where a lot of tribal members were hauled off to Los Angeles, to Oakland, away from their homelands, where they were severed, not just from their tribal customs and the land, but also from their families. And then this was followed by the Self-Determination Act, which was signed by President Nixon, I think in 1975, signed this bill, which really became a hallmark across Indian country. Because first of all, we have to remember that tribes have always been inherently sovereign. We've always been an informed society. So I remember at Oroibi Village that we had our own traditional ways of informing our tribal members. And so in my village, we used to have village criers. And so these were individuals that would climb up to the highest roof in the village, and then they would shout out all the things that the village ought to know, you know, whether it was planting time or whether there was a baby feast or a baby shower. And then following, I think, like the Self-Determination Act, there were also other things going on. And I just want to remind our audience, because this is how we build up to a network. In 1924, June maybe, Native Americans became citizens of the United States through the Snyder Act, which allowed us to vote for the first time. But I remember in Arizona, and your parents and your grandparents probably remember that, it wasn't a smooth transition. That just because this bill passed and it was now the law of the land, which included like tribal citizens, we still had to fight for our right to vote, for example. And there were all kinds of requirements. There was like the voter ID requirement, you know, for people that we didn't carry around IDs back in the old days. And there were other barriers where English literacy tests were like one of the things that was a huge deal, because a lot of our parents and grandparents were monolingual and they weren't raised in an English-only household. And so these were some of the things that were happening. So while all this is going on, our tribes were also transitioning from how they governed and how they held land and how they took care of land. And so I think what we need to remember is that nation building has always been a piece of our sovereign fabric. You know, we were self-governing. We had lands over which we presided, which we use for our sacred traditions, which we use for farming and housing and everything you name it. So we had religious practices and cultural life ways. We had health practices and health practitioners. And so if you look at the 574 recognized, federally recognized American Indian tribes and Alaska Native villages, which is the legal terminology and how we're referred to, they were robust. They were very outgoing and healthy. So I think that lays the groundwork for where we are. And of course, when technology begins to have a greater role, and I mean technology in the sense that new Western technology, because I can tell you natives had technology long, long time ago. They were able to build houses and kivas and, you know, they're doing all kinds. And so they had technology already. So when I'm talking about technology, I'm really talking about new Western technology like broadband and other telecommunications systems that have come into play.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And it's always important for listeners to learn about the histories of Native Indigenous peoples. So I appreciate you going far back into the different things that have impacted our livelihoods up until today.
And I think in terms of, like, to your other question, so in terms of the importance of broadcasting, when new technology came into play, and even though we were now citizens and we were now operating under Western schemes of government, a lot of the transition also required how to phase in like new technologies. And so broadband in 2004 was very low penetration across Indian country, I think less than 10%. Our roads were largely unpaved. There's still no 911 services in many tribal communities. In my village, we didn't have street addresses and still don't. So all these things play a part into how technology becomes important. Although we had tribes that were beginning to do newspapers and that we really relied on them, and I don't know if you remember Wasaja and some of these older newspapers that were really famous, mm-hmm. It was the first time we were doing Western types of information sharing, which was super important because before technology started to take root across Indian country, there were a lot of black holes across Indian country. So I don't know when you got started, but you may have remembered a time when mainstream media didn't include information from Indian country or some parts of the state. I have always thought that to our young people, especially when I'm talking to them, that I tell them that invisibility is not a superpower. Because when you're invisible, people that govern, whether it's at the state level or the federal level, they will forget about you. You don't exist. So if you don't have a voice, if you don't have the power to speak or the power to be heard, they're not going to know that you exist, and they're not going to understand the complexities of the issues that you have to deal with. Or maybe they won't even matter to them. There have been many, many hearings that I've been at congressional hearings where I've had congressional leaders say to my face, like, why do you want broadband for Alaska? There's nothing there. Nobody lives out there, you know, which is totally not true. And the fact that we have about a dozen radio stations dotting Alaska, and these are villages where Alaska Natives have to fly out of. There aren't roads into some of these villages. Can you imagine that? When I had to fly into some of these villages in the early years of 2004, when I was starting Native Public Media, I was learning a lot about our own Indigenous peoples across the United States and learning how rich and vibrant they are and how they're so sophisticated in so many ways and how they deserve to have radio and television to move them up to the next level of exercising their sovereignty.
I feel like radio is still definitely something that folks are creating. So I'm from the Thon-Othum Nation, and they recently just launched the Othum Youth Media broadcast stream. So they have their own streaming channel with their own content and their own music. So It's just come a long ways. But thank you so much. You know, hearing you mention earlier about how when you first started with the Native Public Media, how far back was that when you started?
Oh my gosh, in 2000. So I served as the executive director of the Arizona Indian Gaming Association. And I was hired because the Hopi tribe was a non-gaming tribe, and they wanted somebody that didn't have like a conflict of interest. At the time, we had 21 tribes that were gaming tribes, and they were getting ready to go through compact negotiations, and they wanted me to come and help. They had called me and they said, Loris, they would really like you to come down and help them. And I was like, who's this, you know? So I said, I have a job. And at the time, during that same period, the Hopi people had just started a radio project. And so that was going on. I wasn't interested at the time. John in Alberta would not take no for an answer. And I remember they called me back and they said, can you please come down just to visit? We promise we're not going to like strong arm you or anything, but just come down and listen. And there were people at the time who we all looked up to. I mean, they were the leaders of in Arizona, and they were doing big stuff for tribes all across Arizona. So I went down, and when I walked into the room, it was the leadership of all the gaming tribes sitting around a table. And how can you say no in that situation when they look to you and they say, we need your help? So I did that and helped walk the tribes through the gaming compact. I took care of communications because there was so much opposition at the time, not just from the Senate and the House side of Congress, but also with the state legislators and the dog racing people and everybody else who were concerned that they didn't want the proliferation of gaming to take place across Arizona. And all this stuff was going on. But anyway, I survived that. And there were so many hearings that we went through, and we prevailed. We absolutely prevailed. And so one of the things that I learned from that was that communications is absolutely essential, that if you work with leadership and if you're in a room of 20 plus tribal leaders, that you have to find a way to communicate with them so that we're all on one page, we're all shooting for the same thing, that we are unified because we're stronger in that way. And so there were things that I did in terms of communication with this group. One was to have them give a 5-minute unity talk before we started business of why it was important, giving them space to show that each one in their own, you know, self, in their own person is a leader. They have integrity, they have a voice, and they can speak to their peers. Because the roadmap is clearer when people are allowed to assume their own agency, like exactly what you're doing. You have the power to speak. You have the power to be heard. You're using your own agency, and you're not relying on some outside force to speak for you. You have that power. And so I think that's very true across Indian country, is recognizing what we need. And technology isn't a magic thing. It doesn't really empower people to speak or to be heard. But these are tools that we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. But they make it easier and more universal to speak to others. And thereby, they help to spread the power of our agency further in terms of audience, in terms of topics, in terms of issues that we want to address, and you can captivate an audience through technology. When we have broadcasting facilities, when we have radio or TV, we have the power to communicate not just our values, not just our beliefs, but also our cultures, our traditions. We're able to speak in our language, we're able to share our history, and we're able to captivate the audiences that matter to us the most, which are usually our own very own tribal members. And we're able to talk about important topics. So after I was finished with IGA, I stayed at IGA for about 10 years. I said, listen, I said, I've got to return back to my community. And so I was so done with regulations by then, because gaming is highly regulated. Not only is it regulated by tribes at the local level, it's regulated by the Gaming Commission of the state, it's regulated by federal, the federal government. So there's lots of layers of regulation. And so I decided to go home. And what I wanted to do was rehabilitate old houses that were over 800 years or older, and farming lands, orchards, right? And I said, oh, so glad I'm going to relax and all this stuff. Meanwhile, next door, the radio committee had started the radio project, and they had a consultant that came in to help put the radio together. And they asked me, they said, do you want to join the radio project? You know, I was the associate director. I think that was my title. And so I was like, you know, I'm really looking at architecture, like nice and soft and, you know. And so that's the work I started to do. But our consultant left because, as you know, you're a media person. Do you put in 8 hours a day? Probably put in what, 12? 14, 16, sometimes an overnighter, right?
After my real job, I come home and I focus on podcasting stuff.
Yeah, you see, you know the drill. And so the consultant quickly discovered that this was not an 8 to 5, that she was going home very late at night, you know? And so she quit and she left. And so the wisdom of the executive director was to assign me. And she said, can you go up there? And I said, of course not. You know, I'm like doing my houses, you know, because I had two projects underway. One was in the village of Shungopavi, and one was at Walpi Village. And they were beautiful, just architectural wonders that were built a long time ago by our ancestors. And I wanted to rehabilitate them to the beauty of what they were before. And I wanted to use old technology and new technology, like using the stone and using, you know, rabbit brush for the roof. And that, to me, was really something that moved me. So of course I was not interested in radio. But then I received a letter from one of my board members who was the chair at the time. And it had two lines to it. And I remember them to this day. It said, Dear Loris, you are hereby directed to assume oversight of KUYI Hopi Radio, effective immediately. And then the second line said, and you shall enjoy it. I was so upset. I was like, how can you do this to me? You know, I don't want to go up there, but being that, and I respect authority. So I said, fine. I'm going to remotely work on my, you know, restoration of older houses while I try to do this other stuff. I emerged from that job 2 years later, from that assignment, I should say, when the board announced, they said they were getting ready to find a replacement for me. In a nationwide search for a general manager. And I quickly, by then I was like, what are you guys talking about? This is my station. I was really inducted into a field for which I had never done before, but I knew regulations. That's what I understood. And when I arrived there, I remember finding this huge giant book of regulations. I realized that the clock was ticking and that I had to install equipment, hire people, and get this radio on the air because it has to go through a testing phase. And then the FCC, then if they decide that you're successful in doing that and you're operational, then they grant you a license. So before then, you have what they call a construction permit. So I went through all kinds of things with radio, but I've come to love it because one of the things that it does is that, I don't know where you got your training. Are you self-trained?
So I have two podcasts, actually. One is Thawne Autumn Young Voices, and then I have Cultivating Indigenous Voices.
Nice, nice. So what I learned quickly and how I came to Native Public Media was that I became GM of KUYI. And then I fell in love with it because I learned that if you're tuned into your tribal community. You'll learn that radio can be an asset to the community, but not there to either appropriate or exploit or remove or do all these other things that sometimes people forget where they come from. It's your station, it's your plaza, and this is where you're going to hear news about your communities and the songs and things that matter to you. And so that's how we started at KUII. The first year, you know, I'm working hard to raise money. I'm you know, bringing DJs on. I'm hiring engineers and doing all kinds of stuff. And people don't understand that licensed facilities, licensed radio and TV stations, are highly regulated. They are regulated by the Federal Communications Commission. They are regulated by FAA because of the towers. You don't want an airplane flying into your tower. They're regulated by funders like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So there's all kinds of compliance requirements that stations have to meet. So when you're doing this business, you're putting in long hours, you're trying to be compliant, you're trying to be operational, and you're trying to be sustainable. So over the years, we've doubled in size. We started out with about 20 to 30 stations. Some of them survived, some of them didn't, across Indian country. There's a huge cluster in Alaska. There's about 12 stations there. There's about 10 in Arizona, which are the largest clusters, are Southwest Alaska. And then the Midwest, that's South Dakota, Montana, North Dakota, in that area of the Plains States. They have about a dozen as well. And then the rest are sprinkled across the country. Most of them, if not all, are now west of the Mississippi. And you can tell by the call letters. I think we only have one that's on the eastern side of the Mississippi. So the eastern side of the Mississippi, all the stations start with W. All the stations west of the Mississippi start with what letter?
Hey,
that's right. And I don't know what that means. Like, why is it not a W for West, right? But anyway, and so these stations that came into to play are largely on tribal homelands. The only station that's not located on tribal homelands is KNBA in Anchorage, Alaska. But they're owned and licensed by Alaska Natives. So all these stations are licensed by the FCC. There are some stations that are tribal that operate over the internet. We have three television stations also in our family: GRBC, Gila River Broadcast Corporation, FNX, which is First Nations Experience, operated by the San Manuel Tribe, and CATV, Cheyenne Arapaho Television in Oklahoma. So we have at least three. So about 63 stations altogether. Mm-hmm. And we just ended our summit in New Mexico about a month ago, where the whole family gets to see each other. But I think what we're fighting for, our right to broadcast as sovereign citizens in our native languages. The other thing is that what we've been doing lately is using our radio assets to campaign for a missing and endangered persons alert that's national in scope. So the FCC heard our petition. We had support from the National Congress of American Indians, and they passed the what they call event codes. Event codes are three letters. So the Amber Alert operates off an event code CAE, Child Abduction Emergency. CAE is that event code. Those three letters are used to program software and equipment. But so the MEP alert was adopted on August 7th in 2024, and it will go live on September 8th, wow, 2025. And the reason why there's a whole year from the time it was adopted to the time that it can be implemented, because of those three letters that have to be programmed into a system that covers all 50 states and all U.S. territories. Mm-hmm. So Guam, the Virgin Islands, you know, are included. Yeah. So right now, people say, well, how do states issue missing and endangered persons alerts right now? Well, right now there's no event code, so they're using other codes that don't quite fit. You know, it's like a square peg in a round hole, but they're using event codes that aren't really for MEP just to get the messaging out because it's important. People's lives are at stake. But come September 8th, we'll have a nationwide alert. And how that will work is that eventually it will scoop up all the other alerts that are now being hosted by states. And I'm really grateful to the states that took their own initiative, like Arizona, to pass like the turquoise alert, because there's nothing in place right now. You know, the MEP won't even come into effect till September, but still the problem is there. So there's a crisis and people are dying and disappearing. And so that's the power of having licenses to these broadcast facilities, because when you have a license, you can do more with your facilities. And why not have an MEP alert for Indian country when it's one of the number one issues that our tribal communities are facing today?
Absolutely. I learned about that. It was last year's Native Broadcast Summit that I believe that it was announced about that coming. So it's good to know where it's at now, kind of having an update about it. So thank you for sharing it. An absolute important thing to integrate into radio broadcasting or public media. And it's just one of those things, again, fastest way to help spread that type of information. You know, when I was reading online information, I was on the Native Public Media's website that was published titled When a Station Goes Dark, We Lose. You had mentioned about the current administration and, quote, defund CPB or cuts public broadcasting support. Tribal stations will be the first to go, unquote. So why is it that tribal radio stations would be the first to go if that happens?
So here's what's happening. We are the smallest network in the country, and we get about the $6 to $10 million from what's appropriated to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. If you like dissect that amount, you know, you'll find that some of it will go to Kowanic Broadcasting, some of it to Vision Maker Media, a little bit of that to Native Public Media, and the rest to the 36 stations. So out of the 60 plus stations that we have, only 36 of them get money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They are participating in the Community Service Grant Program. And so these stations apply for this funding, and it's not first money in. These are grants that are matching grants. So the stations have to match what they get from the CPB. So if the CPB goes away, there's been estimates that the 36 stations rely on those monies anywhere from 35% of their annual budget to about 70% of their annual budget. So that's going to be hitting them really hard. And as you know, at this very moment also, all the new federal policies are already impacting tribes, and tribes themselves are now trying to stretch the dollar in covering like services for the elderly. And so we think that if things get really tight, and we have to remember that some tribes also run their own law enforcement, you know, there's gaming operations to consider, and gaming dollars will not cover everything. And so all this matters in terms of the economic landscape of tribes. And so if people aren't understanding the value of radio in terms of like weather alerting or the MEP alert that's going to go over it, or in terms of everything that I talked about, like nation building, where we want an informed society. And so that's what's at stake. But I have to believe that there are enough people out there who feel that tribal nations who are continuously nation building still need an information system which they can support. So that's been my message.
Well, thank you so much, Loris. I appreciate you taking the time to share this information and for all the great work that you are doing on behalf of Native Public Media, but all tribal radio stations and broadcasters, and admire the work that you're doing. And you have so much knowledge and years of experience, and that you're able to contribute all of that, especially in a time like now.
Thank you for having me on your show, which is really wonderful that we have a number of tribal broadcasters and podcasters now.
As we wrap up the interview, any last comments that you would like to share, shout outs that you would like to give?
I want to shout out to all the Arizona stations. It's my home state. I know you guys are doing wonderful work and that you're serving your community. And really, that's the spirit of what we do. Even though you're licensed by a federal agency, when you applied for a license, you said that you are going to be of service to your community. So our market model is definitely different. And I really want to say hello to the rest of the stations across the country. I know that you're doing good work out there, and together we're going to stay strong.
You are tuned in to Cultivating Indigenous Voices from KXEI Tucson, featuring Loris Taylor, President and CEO of Native Public Media, hosted and produced by Tina Andrew. To hear the full conversation, go to kxei.org.